Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Today, we're going to talk about training, the format of a training session, how to apply the UHPC model to format a training session. As you learn about how to develop exercise programs or different training methods or models, you know, you have your warm-up movements and you work into the more intense things that rely on elasticity and power and coordination. So you do those first and then you get into strength work and then you get into some type of conditioning typically. So it's how do we take the unified health and performance continuum model and then use that, the principles and concepts of that, in order to direct how we format a training session.
First things first, you got to have an intention. You have to have a reason why you're doing things versus just doing things, right? We can conceptualize things as a warm-up. We can conceptualize things as however we want to, speed, power, force production, endurance, right? We can do that, but we need to have an intention when it comes to the movement capabilities. Like, are we trying to preserve something specific, and then how are we monitoring for that? So if we know that the more intensive an activity becomes, the movement system simplifies itself. It reduces the degrees of freedom intentionally, because you can't produce high force and have full relative motions at the same time. It doesn't exist, because there's too much energy that would be dissipated in that circumstance. And so again, we have to have an intention, and we have to have a way to monitor for that. If we're trying to maintain something, we have to know what that is. And then that helps us determine, it's like, what is the best course of action as far as an activity is concerned, right? Yeah. So these are things, and again, we have to account for, where are we making ground contact? Are we changing direction? Because those two things are separate as far as internal rotation biases and external rotation biases. And so again, we just have to account for, what are we doing something, and then what are we trying to manage? Those are the first things that you have to determine. And if those are not well defined, then things start to become more and more random. And then we start to lose control over things, and we start chasing a number versus an outcome, which is what we don't want to do.
I think a lot of times when trainers, people that don't know a lot about how you would format or what they're actually trying to accomplish by doing these different training protocols and exercise regimens, they're just chasing the blood, sweat, and tears of it. And that's what they dictate as success. We're talking about how to format a workout, but more so because this podcast is asking people to reconsider what they already sort of know. We've already talked about evaluation and sort of figuring out where people's starting points are. And you might have chessboard measurements. You might have some assessment that the gym uses where you train people. You might have whatever assessment or evaluation that you've done as a clinician, and then you're trying to prescribe an exercise program. So you're always going to have some level of warm-up movement prep in the beginning. Then you're going to progress you to the dynamic activities or something that's going to coincide with the dynamic activities you want to do in your session. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that will be like dynamic warm-up movements. If I'm going to squat, that allow me to capture ranges of motion to squat and then do the squatting motion in some way that I've sort of built up to. We do the power related explosive movements, and then we have our strength movements, and then we have our conditioning and endurance stuff. So the basic way to lay that out would be movement prep, rate of force development and impulse, strength, resistance training activities, and then endurance or conditioning activities. What we're trying to get people to reconsider is that just taking that format and just throwing any type of movement that fits those categories into it just to make a hard workout could potentially be more harmful than helpful. So we're asking people to think about what we need to consider with each one of these segments.
Right.
We'll start with warm-up and movement prep stuff for people.
Okay, so if we were to categorize intentions as So if we were trying to preserve some measure of relative motion as we were performing these activities, number one, relative motion lives inside of the base of support. So we have to make sure that we have access to the ability to superimpose internal rotations on external rotations. So think about activities that would be decelerative as indicating this type of an activity. So my ability to move forward, but to be able to also slow down, right? So think about this for a second. It's like if I was to project myself forward in a broad jump, right? The landing would be my decelerative concerns. That's where I would need to reduce force, dissipate energy, and accumulate relative motions. So on which end of that spectrum is my overall intention of the workout, right? Or which segment of the workout is that of the intention, right? So if I was, again, to try to accumulate the capacity to produce the relative motions, can't be the highest speed activities, can't be the highest of force activities. So it's actually managing the amount of force application or muscle activity that would be using. So when you think about like typical workout structures and things like that, it tends to be ground-based. So I'm rolling around on the ground. I'm doing things where there's a lot of ground contact. So that allows a lot of relative motion to be represented depending on the activities in questions. Like if I'm doing forward and backward rolls or I'm doing some form of long axis rolling, like those are specifically designed to have a lot of ground contact. They're like self-mobilizations. There's a lot of segmental motion that would be associated with those types of activities. So those would be in the earlier stages where I'm trying to bring somebody back inside of their base of support for an activity that would, again, be the ability to decelerate, the ability to absorb a change of direction, the ability to absorb a landing, right? And so, again, if that is the priority of the workout or that segment, then those elements would have to come first. I have to be able to start from that position. If I was to do something that would be too strenuous, too fast, too forceful, I've just taken away those elements.
One of the things that we can apply to all of these aspects that we're talking about, that we like thinking of it as a bell curve. So when we'll think of it as like a bell curve for all, a lot of different aspects. So intensity is going to start low, it will go mm-hmm. high, and then it will end low. Mm-hmm. That would be like your warm-up, workout, cool-down type of scenario.
Right.
Just
right.
As simple as possible. We're talking right. about relative motions.
Yes.
You know, I guess this would be like an inverted bell curve almost, where you yes. have high relative motion, low relative motion, finishing with high relative motion.
Yeah, that would be a way. That would certainly be a way.
I think when it comes to, so when the intention and the goal of exercise and training is to get better at, maybe for in a sporting context, get better at your sport, which there's mm-hmm. going to be a lot of trade-offs for. But if we have just a normal general population client, mm-hmm. they have like this health goal. Mm-hmm. They want to lose weight. They want to look good. They want to be able to stay. And a lot of this is predicated on consistency. So if that is the case, then it's going to behoove me when I'm training someone to let them recover and reclaim relative motion as they're walking out of the gym door, instead of just smashing them and just letting them go back into their natural right. environment. Because right. if I can recover this person every time that they train with me, then that will allow them to come back sooner and we'll be able to get that sort of consistency going.
Things have always been categorized as warm up and cool down, right? But I think it's misleading.
Yeah.
As far as what that really means, right? Because people would just, like, think about it. It's associated with temperature, right?
Sure.
Warm up, get warm, because you do. Like, yeah, you get hot, you get sweaty, and then you cool off. But the reality is what we're actually doing is we're ramping up the nervous system for preparation for higher force, higher velocity activities. And then when we get done with that, we want to tune that back down so we do recapture relative motion, so we do improve circulation, so we do increase the capacity for rest. Because think about this. Every time you're exposed to something that's higher force or higher velocity and you get better at that, your system remains at a point where it can generate more force and more velocity. And it's like, okay, so if my starting conditions the next time I come in are at a higher level, then that's good if that's the intention, right? If health is the intention, however, I could be taking away some measure of health by raising the performance too quickly, right? Or giving up a measure that would be associated with that, right? Mm-hmm. So this could be blood pressure. This could be resting heart rate. This could be like any number of health related conditions. If I don't have the elements built into the programming that will allow me to recapture, like what, again, whatever it might be the lower resting heart rate. It might be the access to hip rotation that I would need to help maintain orthopedic health. Right. It's like, I have to address those things. And that's why I go back to is like always having this intention. It's like, just don't blindly do things.
Right.
Right. And, but this is going to influence all of the decisions through each of these phases. So, yeah. So like say we spend all this time at the beginning of the workout, we're recapturing relative motion. We're getting people inside of the base of support where they can superimpose internal rotations and external rotations. Right. And then I move them to heavy sumo deadlifts, right? Which will necessitate that I take away a large element of what I've already recaptured, right? If I'm in a phase where relative motion is very, very important to me, right? And I need a higher force activity. So we get to this high force producing element of the programming. I can select an activity that from a relative standpoint, facilitates a lower intensity and a much more ideal position for the maintenance of relative motion. So let me give you a comparison. So I already mentioned like the sumo, like heavy sumo deadlift, compare that to a ramp elevated front squat. Okay. Both are higher force than we would say with body weight or with some lower resistance, right? But they have different purposes. You're more likely to retain the relative movement capabilities with the ramp elevated front squat by position, just where the load has to rest relative to the two activities, by the body position that are being utilized, and the interaction between the amount of internal rotation, which is downforce, the amount of downforce that you're applying versus the ability to maintain the expanded representation, which is your external rotation.
Right.
So our exercise selection comes into play because, again, if we have this overall representation, it's like my goal is to have the ability to retain some measure of movement capabilities, my exercise selection has to reflect that. Even though it might be a higher force activity, it's still on the spectrum of high force activities. It's like I'm still playing down at the one end where I have the capacity to maintain more relative motions.
Yeah. And the force activities, the IR activities, those are going to be the things that lose the relative motions. Those are going to be the things that might need to be in the middle mm-hmm. of my training session mm-hmm. So that I have time at the end to reclaim the ranges of motion, to reclaim ER space.
Correct.
So that's also part of the reasons why like the higher velocity movements make more sense in the beginning, because yes. there's less fatigue. And then the velocity component is very dependent on ER space.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Cause it happens off, velocity happens off of the ground. It happens up, right. up into ER land.
Right. So it's away from the long axis. It's like high velocity. Yeah. Like there is like, so you think just about a hub and a wheel. Okay. Real simple. I have a long axis that goes straight down through me. That would be representative of a hub. Everything that's out and around me is representative of a wheel. The higher velocity that I produce, the farther away from the long axis that velocity is produced.
Yeah.
Right. And so that is external rotation. That's what external rotation is away from that midline, away from that long axis. Right. Whether we're talking about sprinting or throwing or changes of direction, there's always that element that's away from midline and away from the long axis. So it stands to reason that those should be when I actually have access to that space.
Yeah. So we're reclaiming the motion outside of the midline, away from the long axis, so mm-hmm. that we can slowly start working our way into producing force down mm-hmm. within our base of support that matches right. our structure in a most maximal IR stopping time right. context.
Correct.
And then being able to reclaim that space to be able to let the circulatory system expand again, to let the mm-hmm. blood flow start to mm-hmm. go throughout the body again, not mm-hmm. restricted by any means, get into right. sort of recovery mode,
right.
Expansion right. mode. Right. So that's that sort of, we're still talking about trying to make this all coherent, that mm-hmm. bell curve of expansion, compression, expansion of ER, IR, ER again, mm-hmm. And then I kind of want to talk a little bit about the phases of propulsion in a training session as well, even though those things sort of coincide. So what we're talking about in the beginning with the you're talking about the decelerative nature of things, the force absorbing side of the energy absorbing side of things. I shouldn't say force absorption.
Because
it's not really what it is.
That is true. That gets misconstrued a lot.
I still make that mistake all the time. So
we talk about it like that. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's like the quick pitch for that is like, I'm not, force is something that you sort of produce in IR. You don't really absorb it, because absorbing in IR, those things are contradictory. You're creating potential energy before becoming kinetic, would be a better way.
That is a better way.
So your stuff in the beginning is going to be earlier propulsive.
Absolutely.
On the absorption end, expansion end. And then we're working you towards a middle. By the end of your warm-up, you should be approaching the most middle representation that you need to perform your exercises in your training session.
Okay.
Right?
So, all right. I need to be able to apply a rapid downforce. So there's going to be, when we talk about being able to access middle, we need to access the middle to get into the late propulsive representation, because that's where like all of your speed and velocity oriented activities are going to have a very strong late propulsive representation, which starts from a position of internal rotation. Okay. Yeah. But the ground contacts are brief. Okay. That's going to be the distinguishing characteristic, because we're going to talk about IR in two different ways. IR is definitely the downforce, but for me to be able to demonstrate velocity, the ground contact has to be shorter. Okay. Otherwise, if I prolong the ground contact, I'm increasing the duration of the IR application. I'm able to accumulate lots of force there, but I'm going to dampen my ability to produce velocity. Okay.
Right. Which is like, if your session was purely focused on powerlifting, that dampening the velocity display might not be a big deal.
It's not
necessarily. Yeah. But if your goal is to be able to like play with your kids and go like to the park with them and, you know, go up and down the stairs without any sort of pain, then you're going to need to take this person through this full display of early, middle, late.
Right. Right. So we have this decelerative element that's early propulsion. Okay. And then we have a time constrained application of IR. Okay. There is always a time constraint that would be associated with it. So I accumulate my ability to push down inside of my base of support. I do that quickly. Then the next thing that you would be able to do is to be able to prolong the IR. So now we're going to talk about high force, right? So that's a longer duration of IR application. So these would be your highest force producing activities without a time constraint.
Right. So these are your, this is where we're in the resistance training part of the
session. Very much so. Right. And then again, it's like, we have to take this overall picture. It's like, okay, where are we, what are we trying to emphasize? Like if preservation of relative motions is not the concern, and highest possible force output is the concern, there's a trade-off. You don't get to keep both to the maximum degree. Virtually impossible. Okay. There is a trade-off. Okay. So if we're going to give up one for the other, then we have to understand that. Okay. But like I said, if movement preservation is still a concern, that's just exercise selection. Right.
Right.
That's like, that's taking somebody from a bilateral symmetrical heaviest possible load activity to a bilateral symmetrical self constrained activity. Like again, using the front squat versus a deadlift example, they are not in the same world, right? One is by physical position, by structure, is going to preserve more motion than the other. Both will appear to be high effort. I get that. Awesome. Right. Maybe you're the world's greatest front squatter and, you know, and the way you execute is not going to preserve nearly as much relative motion as somebody else who is of lower intensity capabilities. But generally speaking, if we were making comparisons between those two activities with the same person, we would have greater preservation of relative motions with front squat. If I'm not concerned about that, I'm going to go after the highest force producing activity, which would be, again, more of like on the deadlift end of the spectrum. Very IR oriented, very middle propulsive. Again, unconstrained by time.
So it's less, yeah. And that, those choices that you make in terms of exercise selection are going to be less about trying to fit everyone within to these boxes of like push, pull, squat, hinge, unilateral, bilateral, and more. What's your goal and what's your structure?
Right.
And those, and then if your goals are very specific to force production, say like you are a Olympic lifter, power lifter, those programs, not saying that they're the same, but they're going to be, there's going to be a lot more trade-offs there than there would be from someone who's just like a 55-year-old soccer mom who doesn't want to have this persistent upper back pain that she's been having for the last 10 years. And she still wants to be able to train to be healthy, feel good, look good.
Like the thing that we have to be concerned about is blindly associating the capacity for greater force production with health.
Yeah, or performance too. Like, I think that's a huge, that's a huge mistake that people make.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh, my back hurts. I just need to get stronger. Well, what methodology would you be using to get stronger? Well, it could be the thing that reinforces the reason you have the pain in the first place.
Right.
We need to understand that. It's like, we can't just blindly say, oh, you have such and such a weakness. We need to make that stronger. We will do an activity that strengthens that muscle. Like that's a total misunderstanding of relationships and actually how we go about producing force in that circumstance.
Yeah. And honestly, in a lot of cases, when someone experiences success with symptom alleviation by taking that sort of route, a lot of times it's just because they're adding, if there is focal compression in one spot that's causing symptoms, they then add compression everywhere so that it sort of distributes the compression.
Yes, exactly.
But you are actually robbing them of motion. So then a low back pain goes away, but becomes a shoulder issue or a neck issue
or a
something potentially.
Yeah.
So it's like you are making this person more compressed, so they are stronger. I'm making air quotes for those on our Spotify and Apple. But yeah, it's like, and then, you know, because there will always be someone that listens to this and goes, you know, Bill doesn't want anyone to lift weights. And
that's
it's like,
true.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, like, they're going to be like, oh, well, you know, I do deadlifts and RDLs and bench press. And
my back pain got better and I'm fine.
All of my clients' back pain goes away. And I'm offering you, you know, what we would call a counterfactual for why that might be happening. I'm not disagreeing that your client's symptoms have gone away. You haven't like psychologically manipulated them to them thinking they don't have pain anymore. I'm offering you the reasons for why some of these programs that, you know, I used to do with people 10 years ago, why they worked, why they
helped. We've all had that scenario.
Yeah, right. We're trying to just offer a better perspective and a different way to sort of reconsider what, because none of this is new. A lot of the stuff will just seem like we're talking about the stuff that you already do. And that's exactly the point, is that you already do all the stuff that you need to do. We're giving you a better perspective on why you should do it. And maybe we can help make the efficiency or optimization of your programming a little bit better.
Right. The goal is to improve your ability to reason.
Yeah.
Right. To understand why you're doing things on a much deeper level versus just superficially saying, everybody needs to squat. Everybody needs to bend. Everybody needs to lunge. Everybody needs to be able to
jump
or whatever it might be. Yeah.
Right. And certain people have in the past were just laying out categories for these are the necessary things to train somebody in like a balanced way. And it offers a framework that makes sense from just working all of the muscles of the body, but it doesn't take into account all of these other things that we can see from a principles and concepts way through the UHPC model. So I think just real quick, I want to get into some examples. I want to give people some sort of real life examples of what we're talking about. I'll list out what a session might look like for a mom who has a history of back pain or something like that. So we're talking about ground-based activities, any type of foam rolling or self-applied mobilization that I'm using in coordination with maybe a physical therapist that's seeing this person. So I know that this person lacks tibial IR or something like that. So they're doing a mobilization with a band or a foam roller. And that's one of their specific things. They're trying to reclaim tibial IR on the right. Uh-huh. Say that. So they're doing some stuff with their feet. They're doing some stuff with foam rollers. And then I'm going to have them progress to some rolling activities on the ground, maybe some positional breathing to acquire some space where I don't have it. And then I will build this person up from the floor to, you know, a low oblique, high oblique, kneeling, standing static, standing dynamic movements, and then sort of walking propulsion related stuff. So more like a cone to cone style athletic warm up that might include different types of marching or skipping, mm-hmm. or carrying weights or dragging sleds or whatever I'm trying to do. What we're still trying to apply the same things that Bill and I were referring to, where we're moving from the absorption side to the producing side. Having this person who has a health goal be able to display the full early to middle to late propulsion pieces that we're looking for. And then within her training session, if the goal is of the resistance training, being able to put force into the ground within her base of support where we want it to go, but not push her back towards her past strategies that brought her back pain about.
Right. So let's pause there for a second.
Yeah.
And like from an exercise selection standpoint, your bilateral symmetrical activities are more likely to magnify the typical compressive internally rotation based strategies.
So those are the things that we're going to ask you to reconsider and potentially avoid, because those will interfere with her goal of maintaining this range of motion and relative motions that where her back pain's not going to come back.
Right.
But people were already, I keep going back to this, but people were already doing this. People were already choosing exercises. They weren't doing back squats anymore or squatting because it hurt people's backs. So they started doing split stance activities because single leg was somehow better for low backs.
It's
nice. Now what we're talking about with the space from front to back, preserving rotations and turns, that perspective makes a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. Instead of this one, we're going to blame the low back and the bilateral deficit. And that's, we're going to say that's the reason. Right. It certainly is it's based on mistakes that were made, right? It's based on trainers and coaches hurting enough people with certain exercises to figure out that if they did other exercises, they didn't hurt people anymore.
Right.
But it's not based on principles.
Well, it's not based on reasoning.
Yeah. It's not based on why. Yeah.
Right.
That's based in like physics or structure.
Right. We want to understand it. So there is a certain type of activity where greater range of motion can be expressed. There is a shape and a space and a contact that allows me to turn. There are activities that take that away, right? There are consequences in both circumstances, right? Where one might be of benefit and the other one is detrimental. That's the thing that we want to understand. We can refine our understanding of what's happening at certain times in certain circumstances, and then we can choose better options to support our intentions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, with that in mind, her resistance training might be more alternating activities with the upper body where I'm not asking her to grind against weights. I'm not giving her super heavy weights with her upper body, because someone with this, say she has a narrow pylon structure, so she already has a pretty high pressure upper body. So if I give her really heavy weights and have her try to do some presses, even if she is quote unquote strong enough to do it, I'm going to exacerbate that pressure differential and just create even more high pressure up top, which could potentially just exacerbate her back issues.
Yeah.
So we're going to keep it on the lighter side, make sure she can breathe through the movements, still get an effect, training effect with the muscles potentially, still get this sort of like full body exertion against resistance. Because if I'm focusing on bone density or muscle mass or anything like that, I'm going to need that stimulus. But I just don't want to detract from what the initial goal was of like maintaining health, not provoking symptoms of low back pain. And then like you had mentioned, I'm not going to trap bar deadlift this person immediately. Or maybe ever. I'm not going to bilateral squat them. I might do step-ups, which are within their very narrow base of support. I might do a front foot elevated split squat to start, because it puts me in more of that ER position to allow me to be on more of the absorption side of things.
Right.
And then those are going to be some of the brief choices that I would make there. And then from a conditioning component, this person shouldn't be doing something that's going to require a lot of IR and fatigue, because that would lead them right back to that place. So I'm thinking like in CrossFit, they do like a thing called like a wall ball where you do a squat and you do like a medicine ball throw up on a wall for time. That would be something I wouldn't want to do with this type of person because it would just push her back towards what she was doing.
Well, something is simple in this circumstance. You have somebody that is biased towards a top-down pressure gradient and you put them on a rower.
Yeah.
Huge mistake.
And based on what that reinforces
everything that we were trying to overcome.
That's a machine version of the activity I was just explaining, basically. Yeah. So it's just like your bilateral movement, you're squeezing a ton with the upper body. So I'm forcing the volume down into the legs. And I'm just bending the spine in order to try to get this propulsion to happen.
You're in a seated position. Which makes it very difficult to create enough pressure to overcome the top-down pressure gradient. It's much harder.
Because you're not pushing down into the ground inside your base of support anymore.
Well, yeah, I am literally in a position where I'm in a force absorption. I'm in a better force absorption position versus a force production position.
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah. Yeah. It's the decelerative position where I'm trying to produce force. So the way that you produce force in that position is actually to squeeze the thorax from front to back. That's how you actually produce force in that circumstance. Right. But I have a pelvic orientation that's in a force absorbing position. Therefore, it's counter to the goal.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that was like a health example. I think that one is like the most applicable to many of the people watching this. From a performance perspective, like if you were training a power lifter, say you are going to be less concerned with a lot of the things that we just talked about and more concerned with the numbers. You're going to be more concerned with, you're going to get them enough relative motion back so that they can live their life and like wipe their butt when they poop. But other than that, like if they're in season for their sport or their competitions, you don't want to take too much away from the force production side.
That's why you'll see bilateral symmetrical exercises out the wazoo in those circumstances. Yeah. Yes.
And they find ways, not by using this model, but they find ways where they can kind of fill in the pressure changes and the shape change stuff. So like they'll use like a box squat for their velocity stuff, because the softness of the box will allow the pelvic outlet to actually move for once.
Yeah, there's times and places where I'm still powerlifting, but I'm using strategies that will sort of bias me a little bit more in the health preservation direction, right?
Yeah.
It's like you think about like conditioning for powerlifters has always been what?
West Side, they do just like speed work.
Or
that's the conditioning. Or sled drags.
Okay, so there you go. So there we get an asymmetrical activity, right? So they're doing all sorts of variations on a theme. Okay, much lower in intensity, right?
Right.
And again, it's a reduction in the demands on force production. There's elements of turns that are associated with those activities as well within a certain range.
Yeah, right? It's still very long ground contacts.
They don't want to take away from their force producing capabilities. They want to hang on to just enough health that allows them to do everything that they want to do. With the understanding that I know that I am sacrificing relative motion. I know that there are elements of health that I am interfering with, but my goal is not that. My goal is the maximum level performance. And there is the trade-off.
Well, that and when it comes to like the recovery aspect, enough anabolic drugs and you get a little bit of recovery. It's the sport. I'm not saying doesn't make any of these people bad people. You gotta do it.
Not at all.
Okay. I think that's good.
All right.
I think we accomplished what we wanted to. Hopefully it was something that people can take away. And the intention of what we just talked about, I just want people to sort of be like, oh, I already do that, or I've been doing that, or I've seen that, and now I have the sort of reasoning in my mind of why that works.
Is there a better reason why I do what I do? It's like, that's the thing that you should always be striving for. That's the refinement. It's like, that's why everybody looks at their progress from 5 years ago and wants to throw up in their mouth, is because their perspective improves over time. It's like, why would I have chosen that? Why would I have chosen this? This is what we're talking about. But we're talking about accelerating that understanding.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, improving their reasoning, seeing where the potential interference has been, the bin in your past programs, seeing that like what things that you can remove, and then maybe things that you can do more of or amplify that were helping, but you couldn't really figure out or had any sort of reasoning why.
Right.
Okay. Right. There's going to come a point where we've had so many episodes that I don't have any sort of these questions to ask people anymore.
We need popular culture elements.
Yeah. Well, because I was going to ask about people's favorite gum, but I think we've already done
that. We have already done the gum. Yeah.
Did we talk about like protein powder?
Ooh. That's
because protein powder is a pretty recent thing, right? And in the early stages of it don't count because it was absolutely disgusting.
Yeah,
I'm talking about clumpy, commercialized,
the clumpy stuff, Play-Doh smelling, right. Just the horrible, nasty.
You had to buy it from like a very specific type of supplement or bodybuilding store. Oh, yeah. You couldn't get it. You couldn't go to the grocery store and get it. I'm talking about the modernized, commercialized version of protein powders.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember. Well, let's talk about some of the disgusting ones. What were some of the ones in the beginning? I remember I got one that came in a big tub. It wasn't really labeled. It just kind of said protein on it, which is black lettering. And it had egg. It was like egg and beef protein powder together. Mm-hmm. And it was terrible.
I think the first one. So here you go. So I grew up in York, Pennsylvania.
In 1796.
Hey, the first capital. It's the first capital of the United States, so there's a French.
Well, it was the capital back when you were
okay,
little.
Okay, but this was Bob Hoffman, so York Barbell, York Barbell, and Hoffman's. So that was my first introduction. Like, and I was like 9 at the time, and I was aware. I was aware of like York Barbell Club, of course, and then I knew who Bob Hoffman was. So he had, I think it was MLO. And I'm not sure what it stood. I think that was the name of the protein. That was the first one I think that was exposed. I think it was MLO. I could be wrong on that, but that pops into my head. But I knew it's something that was generated by him. Like it was this is like before Joe Weider. Like Joe Weider was next on the list with like weight gainer number 7 and whatever mass and stuff like
right,
that.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I think the big ones when I was coming up were Optimum Nutrition, still one of the top brands out there. Yeah, that was most of what I have. But
what was the first whey, the first protein that was just like when whey became really, really big? And I think I want to say that Dan Duchesne was the guy that promoted it, I think.
Yeah, any of the other old heads who listen to the podcast would be able to tell us, I'm sure. Yeah. But yeah, leave in the comments, leave your horror stories of your initial protein powders that you had. Because there were some disgusting,
they're nasty.
Generic nasty. White bags of stuff.
Who knows what was in it?
Yeah, all right. Thanks, everybody.